This is News in Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, race, America's last taboo. The government spends millions on an investigation, but what do they have to show for it? No Afros in the workplace and gay foster care. We'll take it all on. Joining us today from our West Coast facility is actor and columnist Joseph C. Phillips. From Maryland, George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Association. And Deborah Dickerson, author of The End of Blackness. She joins us from Albany, New York. I thank you all. Let's talk a little bit about what we just heard. Forgive me. We just heard, and that is from Charles Barkley and his question in the new book, what I call America's Last Taboo and Race. First and foremost, George Curry, let me start with you. Do you believe that to be the case, that it is truly America's last taboo?
I don't know if it's the last one, but it's certainly one of the most enduring ones. I have not read Barkley's book and really don't have an enthusiasm for reading it. That's not where I get most of my information. But he did make some good points. Some I agree with, some I don't.
Deborah, let me ask you, as relates to race in this country, one of the interesting questions that he raises is the fact that there are so many perspectives of race, and it typically comes from who you are and obviously what your background is. But first and foremost, we do not like to talk about this issue in mixed company, even today.
Well, I think minorities like to talk about it in mixed company, and I think it's whites who are much less prone to talk about it in mixed company because they're the most likely to get in trouble or to feel that to feel defensive and that they can't really say what they think. I remember once I was telling some white friends when I was a staff attorney at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, I was saying that I thought race relations had taken a turn for the better. And I remember one of the white lawyers turned to me and very sadly said, "That's because you don't hear what white people say when there aren't any black people in the room." So I think it's easier maybe for people of color, but it's incumbent upon all of us to have a little courage and take a chance on having somebody call you a racist. I mean, I've been called awful names and I didn't die.
Yet it's interesting, Deborah, before I go to Joseph and weigh in with him on this, that and Charles brings it up in the book, when you talk about wanting to talk about it openly or willingness to talk about it openly, that may be the case black to white, but often black to black, as we saw with Bill Cosby and race and the question of. That sometimes can be an issue of how far you want to go in public without, if names are to be called, being thrown the Tom label.
Oh, absolutely. I think if you look in the dictionary under Uncle Tom, you'll probably see my picture there. I've been called that so many times. When I was
right
in law school.
Right next to mine, Deborah.
Yeah, when I was in law school, the Black Law Student Association, people would hiss me at meetings because there are just things that you can't say. But on this topic of having discussions between groups, I think one of the things sometimes that minorities don't get is that you're not there to lecture. You don't have a monopoly on wisdom. And I think a lot of times we want to say white people, this is what you should think. You don't have anything to say. Just sit there and be lectured to. And that's not going to help us.
Joe? And Ed, I think that we are constantly talking about race. Race is this nation's original sin. We've been talking about it since black people first came to these shores. It's been our most extended conversation, and I'm with Deborah on this that I think black people particularly talk about race constantly, and what's interesting to me is that in private, at least, I think black people more than white people go through these machinations about race and how race works in our daily lives, in relation to in the workplace and at the grocery store, and do people just don't like us because we look too good, or is there some racial aspect to it? You know, there are all these gymnastics that I think that black people do go through that white people don't. And we're constantly talking about it.
I think what's interesting is that how it has changed. I grew up under Jim Crow in Alabama, and now you go to Alabama or Louisiana, any other southern state, that has changed on the outside tremendously, and that has been progress. We have to admit that. But what we're seeing is so many forms of soul racism. For example, you know, of all places, when you go to New Orleans, you don't worry about going on Bourbon Street. Everybody's having fun. Yet you just found out that when they sent testers out, that African Americans are charged 40% more, in 40% of the cases, charged more than a white person for the same drink. This is like even after they've had a racial incident. And when I go on college campuses, and we all speak across this country, you know, and I have people come to me and say, well, I'm colorblind. I say, is that so? And then what I like to do is pull the personals out for each community. Just pull out the personals where people already decide what race they want to date, and they don't know. It could be done with a mass murderer. They simply say, I want a white person or Asian person or a black person, and that becomes their foremost goal, and I think that really underscores the problem we have in this country.
Joseph Phillips, you suggest that, in your words, blacks go through more machinations, but isn't that the case in the sense that they face more than whites would in those same situations?
No, absolutely. I mean, the example I used, I mean, oftentimes you go someplace and you just don't know whether, you know, somebody's looking at you because they just don't like you because they don't like you, or like you because you look good, or you don't know if there's a racial aspect to it. And there's always this kind of testing, I think, that goes on.
Well, it's also interesting, Deborah, to note, and you can tell it by the emails we receive here daily, there are people who will on one day suggest that the show is becoming, quote, too black, too many issues, too this, too that. And then the very next email will say that you're not black enough, you're not dealing with
right.
it. Isn't that part of the problem, again, the prism that you look through?
It is. It's a huge part of the problem. And I go back and forth myself on that. It's like, why should I do a black news show? I should just do a news show. But then you do a news show and you never talk about, it's like this whole other part of the world doesn't exist. So we black people need to be given our due. It's hard. It's a full-time job being black. You know, it's so complicated. But I'm the same way myself. Sometimes it's like, no, I'm only going to just do journalism. A good story is a good story. But then it's like, but there are things that I never read if we don't have these kind of forums. So it's important to listen to these critiques and to have a sort of a gut check. You know, it's like, are we too black? And I think the only time you can say you're too black is when you're talking about issues that really are just unworthy. So the black issues that are just they're just black and they're not worthy of the amount of time they're getting. And I think as long as we're not doing that, this is sometimes it's our duty to air these issues.
Well, I think it goes back to what W.E.B. Du Bois talked about, this whole two-ness. This is, we are forced to live in two worlds, and we live in our world and we live in the larger world. And it's just a burden you carry being an African American in this country. I remember when I went to out of the country one time, and did not feel the pressure of race one time, I said, you know what? I can't imagine what that's like, you know, to just not have to carry around the burden of race.
Well,
but
think
sometimes it's really cool having two worlds, though, isn't it? You know, today I'm doing
make
NPR.
Make your skin sort.
well, yeah, definitely.
That was
but
the word I was trying to come up with, and I couldn't think of.
But I was in church yesterday, and I was just, you know, it's a Baptist church, and I was just sort of sitting there thinking, man, this is so black. I'm just this. People were holy dancing, and the minister. It was just so black, and I was just loving it, you know. But then there are other days where I feel like, you know, the schism is just going to drag me into. But I try to keep from crazy. I try to focus on just thinking, isn't it cool to have two cultures? Isn't that just cool?
Well, before
we move on, though,
one of the issues, too, is the labeling. I mean, Deborah, you suggest, you know, why should I do a, quote, black news show or a black program? Shouldn't I just do a news program? But one would define black usually by the host or the people that produce it, yet we don't call mainstream news white news shows, and yet oftentimes that host is white and the majority of the people that work there are white.
Well, that drives me crazy. That's like the race card and the gender card. You know, the only time you can play, the only black people, only people who are not white play the race card, and only people who are not men play the gender card. Do not get me started on that.
All right, well, we won't. Lest we forget, bringing up what George suggested, every day you're reminded of this. Here's a case out of Philadelphia. A former salesperson for a Philadelphia radio network, Eagles radio network, the football team, there has won a judgment in a discrimination case. It was ruled in the salesman's favor that after considering evidence that included a book given to this employee by the network, that he is employed by that advise blacks selling to whites not to wear afros or African-style clothing. The same book advised Hispanic salespeople to avoid, quote, hair tonic that tends to give a greasy or shiny look to the hair, end quote. And they suggest that this would avoid negative reactions from would-be clients. What does this say, if anything, George Curry?
Well, I mean, let's be real. If you're in a certain profession, you do need to dress a certain way. You know, I always laugh, and I probably get kidded about this. I said the first thing they do if you're going to move it loud in corporate America is cut off your mustache if you're a black man. A few exceptions to that. In most cases, that's true. I think there are certain dress codes that you're going to deal with, and not all of it's race-based. I mean, it's not. And that's just the reality of it.
I wonder if the book also suggested that he should clean his nails, brush his teeth, remove any piercings, cover up tattoos. You know, I tried to do some research on this, and there's not a lot of information that I was able to find on this story. But I tended to think that this just kind of indicates how litigious we are. You know, if I own a business, I think that it's my right to set the standard of dress and suggest that people dress a certain way when they come to work for me. And quite frankly, if you don't like it, then go work someplace else. You don't have to take folk to court. And this guy only worked there for, and again, I don't know all of the details, but he worked there for less than a year. And I'm just not convinced that this book, which obviously contained a lot more information than just that, was worth $600,000. You know, just go someplace else and work. Stop being so thin-skinned about everything.
Yeah, Deborah Dickerson, I don't know this to be the case, obviously, but one would question whether or not the Eagles would suggest if, for instance, Pat Riley came in to work for them, that they would suggest to him that he should stop using the tonic that makes his hair slick and greasy looking.
But if he was selling insurance, you know, maybe they would. But if he was, you know, doing what he does, I'm assuming he's some sort of big sports guy.
I don't know a lot about sports. Coach of, former okay. coach of the Los Angeles
right.
Lakers.
So
now
he writes the rules.
He writes the rules, you know.
If he was selling insurance, though, he'd be working for somebody. But you know what? Let me just take a slightly different tack on this. I mean, I went to law school in my 30s, and I had this whole black renaissance thing, nappy hair, no chemicals, no nothing. I was happily nappy. And when it came time to interview for law firms, George, you mentioned black men cutting off their mustaches. All the women suddenly went from combat boots and torn fishnets to, you know, Amish. I called it, campus suddenly became Amish, as I put it. And all the women who had dreads and braids got their hair straightened. And I had to have a talk with myself. I said, I understand that to go into an interview with a great big shaggy afro I have to decide what my cultural expressions means to me. And either I'm going to pay the price, because people can say diversity, we love you, but what's going on in their hearts, I don't know. And if I have to go out and face clients, is a person going to not buy from me because I got a big afro? That's something I have to ask myself in my heart, how much my culture means to me. So I think to put the onus on the other person, and like you, Joe, I would like to see what that book said. It may be saying, look, if you're a salesman and you're trying to make the maximum commissions, you might want to dress this way. And I'd have to see the whole thing, but I'm looking at it from the other point of view, and this is something women, I think, have to deal with, and minorities. And I will never again straighten my hair, but I understand that that might cost me. Other people cannot make your culture okay for you. If you're different, you have to accept the responsibility that
right.
entails.
Let me get this in very quickly.
Joe, very quickly. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that one of the great actresses, Rosalind Cash, the late Rosalind Cash, went through something very similar. She was the first black woman in Hollywood to dread her hair. Rosalind did not work for years because of that. And like Deborah said, there's a cost that you pay. And she, in her mind, said that is the cost. If I have to live in a garage in Venice and grow my own vegetables, that's the cost. And eventually Hollywood caught up with her, clearly, but there were some lean years in there. And you know, the bottom line is if you're making sales and if you're producing, then I don't think people really care whether you wear an afro or not.
But. All right, let me get this in very quickly. The Senate agreed on Friday of last week to cut off money for the decade-long investigation of former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Henry Cisneros, which has cost nearly $21 million over that 10 years. The largest expenses over the course of a six-month period in 2004 went for salaries, benefits, and contracted services because essentially the case has petered out. As many remember, Cisneros in 1999 lied to the FBI about how much he paid a former mistress when they were considering him, when he was being considered for another cabinet job. He pled guilty to a misdemeanor and was fined $10,000, pardoned by President Clinton in 2001. That being said, George Curry, with about a minute and a half left, what of the idea of this costing taxpayers upwards to $21 million?
It should have been closed down at least 6 years ago. I mean, probably this should have never been started. We're talking about something that happened that started 10 years ago. I think he pleaded guilty 6 years ago. Clinton gave him a pardon 4 years ago. I mean, this thing should have been long over, but it was remaining open, and it shows how once these things just get started, it's a complete waste of taxpayers' money.
Let me get this straight. The federal government is wasting money? I'm shocked.
While that may be a shock, we should note that these kinds of independent counsel investigations, frankly, go on more often than I think the public is aware of, and millions of dollars are spent, oftentimes, as we see in this case, with cases or investigations that have essentially either corrected themselves or certainly lent themselves to some kind of conclusion.
Well, and, what's the mechanism for policing the people who make the laws? So it's when you look at all the budget cuts that are going on, the terrible deficit, they're going to privatize Social Security, all these things. It's just the bankruptcy laws. I mean, it makes a conspiracy theorist out of you. We've got money for this sort of thing, but, you know, we don't have money for arts programs. We don't have money for music. We can't fix our public schools. It's enough to just, this is where, you know, the public cynicism comes from.
And we should note that the GAO would be that mechanism, the Government Accountability Office, who released the findings on this. And some suggest that they are part of the problem, but that is at least the arm that's there. George Curry, Deborah Dickerson, and Joseph C. Phillips, thank you all for joining us. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.